Welcome to Base by Base, the papercast that brings genomics to you, wherever you are. Thanks for listening, and don't forget to follow and rate us in your podcast app. Imagine a pathogen gets inside your body, right? And its primary survival strategy isn't just to quietly siphon off your nutrients.
Right, that would be way too simple.
Yeah, exactly. Instead, its goal is to physically remodel your anatomy. It specifically targets your throat, just to make sure you physically cannot swallow. You become perpetually starved.
It's a genuinely horrifying thought experiment.
It really is. You get so desperate because of this microscopic sabotage that you're forced into this frantic state. You just start biting everything around you.
And because you can't swallow, you're constantly regurgitating the very pathogen that is choking you into every single wound you create.
Right. And today we celebrate the work of Owino, Yanasei, and their incredible research team who have advanced our understanding of this exact biological hijack.
Yeah, it's a ruthless, highly orchestrated piece of evolutionary engineering. And that horrifying mechanism is exactly how the Leishmania parasite operates inside its insect vector, the sandfly.
It's a total masterclass in biological manipulation. Their team recently published a phenomenal study in PNAS, a 2026 paper that finally maps out the mechanics of this hijack.
They basically reverse engineered the microscopic suction cup that this parasite builds to lock onto the sandfly's throat. It is one of the most elegant examples of a pathogen guaranteeing its own transmission.
And when you look at the global footprint of Leishmania, I mean, the stakes of understanding that spread become incredibly clear for you as a listener.
Oh, absolutely. It causes leishmaniasis, which puts over 1 billion people at risk globally.
1 billion people. That's just wild. And the entire transmission cycle relies on the parasite bouncing between a mammalian host and the sandfly, right?
Right. And the absolute bottleneck in that transmission cycle is a highly specific developmental stage of the parasite. It's known as the haptomonad stage.
Okay, let's unpack this. Because the haptomonad stage is, it's specialized for just one task, right?
Exactly. When a sandfly ingests infected blood, the parasites multiply in the midgut. But eventually they differentiate into these haptomonads and migrate forward to a very specific anatomical target.
Which is the stomatal valve.
Yes. That valve is essentially a muscular, chitin-lined sphincter. It regulates the flow of blood into the fly's digestive tract. And the parasite doesn't just hang out there.
Right. It initiates this massive biological roadblock. It secretes this dense extracellular matrix like a viscous, sticky gel.
And at the same time, it inflicts severe physical damage directly to the cuticular lining of the valve itself.
So it essentially shreds the valve and just like glues the remnants shut.
Exactly. And the physiological cascade that triggers in the fly is exactly what the parasite needs. Entomologists call the resulting behavior frequent but incomplete feeding.
Because the fly's gut is blocked, so it literally can't get a full blood meal.
Right. It is perpetually starving. So it aggressively attacks mammalian hosts, just biting repeatedly.
But the blood can't pass through that blocked stomatal valve.
Nope. The fluid pressure forces the fly to regurgitate, vomiting the infectious parasites packed in its foregut straight into the bite wound.
Wow. But to pull that off, I mean, the physical biomechanics are just mind-bending.
They really are. The sandfly is actively trying to draw viscous blood through that microscopic aperture.
So the sheer stress of the blood rushing through has got to be immense. For a single-celled organism to hold on against that rushing current, it would be like trying to hold on to the inside of a fire hose with one hand while someone turns the hydrant on full blast.
That is a perfect analogy. And dealing with that fluid dynamic challenge requires a massive physical transformation.
It can't just swim against it, right?
No, standard motility wouldn't work at all. It heavily modifies its flagellum. Instead of the typical, you know, long whip-like structure, it morphs into this shortened bulbous appendage.
And right at the tip of that stumpy flagellum, it constructs this dense cytoskeletal array, which they call the adhesion plaque.
Exactly. That plaque is the anchor. It's what keeps the parasite bolted to the chitin lining, despite the extreme shear forces of the incoming blood.
But mapping out a molecular structure like that presents a massive technical wall for scientists. I mean, we knew about 3 canaloplasted insect adhesion proteins, right?
Right, CanP1, 2, and 3. We knew they acted as critical nodes.
But an adhesion plaque is essentially biological concrete. If you think about traditional proteomics, historically you'd try to use immunoprecipitation.
Yeah, you'd normally break the cell open and use antibodies to pull out the protein complexes.
Which completely fails here, right? Because it's so insoluble.
Completely fails. If you use detergents harsh enough to actually dissolve an adhesion plaque, you destroy all the delicate protein interactions you're trying to study.
You just end up with a soup of disconnected parts.
Exactly. The structural integrity of the plaque makes traditional affinity purification nearly impossible.
Which is why the methodology in this deep dive is so cool. It forced the team to bypass traditional methods entirely and use something called tuboid B proximity labeling.
It's such a brilliant workaround. Rather than trying to extract the plaque intact, Turboid lets you map the structure in situ.
While the parasite is still fully adhered and alive, I like to think of it as a localized molecular paint bomb.
A molecular paint bomb is exactly what it is.
They genetically fused the turboid tag, which is basically a hyperactive biotin ligase directly onto one of the known anchor proteins, KIAP3.
Right. And once the parasites attach to a surface and build their plaques, the researchers trigger the system by flooding the environment with biotin.
And boom, the paint bomb goes off. That enzyme immediately catalyzes the attachment of biotin to anything nearby.
But the critical factor here is the labeling radius. Turboid operates within a roughly 10 nanometer sphere.
Which is an incredibly tight blast radius in cellular terms.
It really is. It ensures that you are strictly tagging proteins that are physically interacting with or sitting immediately adjacent to the KIP3 anchor point.
Right, within that dense cytoskeletal mesh. And once that 10 nanometer zone is tagged with biotin or, you know, painted extraction, it becomes vastly simpler.
Oh yeah, you don't have to worry about keeping the protein complexes intact anymore. You can just oilize the cells with the harshest detergents available.
Just completely solubilize everything. And then you drop in magnetic beads coated in streptavidin, right?
Exactly. Streptavidin has one of the strongest non-covalent affinities in nature for biotin. So the magnetic beads just grab anything covered in the biotin paint.
And you just wash away the rest of the unpainted cellular debris. It's elegantly brutal.
It's a beautifully brutal way to isolate specific structural neighborhoods, but proteomics at this level still generates a massive amount of noise.
Yeah, when they ran those purified proteins through the mass spec, they initially detected nearly 3,000 distinct proteins.
Which is huge.
Yeah.
A lot of those are just transient visitors or really highly abundant background proteins.
So filtering that noise requires some really aggressive data reduction. They set incredibly stringent cutoffs to find the permanent structural components.
Right. They restricted their focus strictly to proteins that were enriched at least fourfold over their baseline controls.
And they also demanded high abundance. The mass spec had to detect a minimum of 15 unique peptides for a given protein to even make the list.
That level of stringency slashed the list of suspects from 3,000 all the way down to just 58 high confidence candidates.
But you know, chemical proximity in a mass spec doesn't definitively prove structural integration. You still need spatial confirmation.
Exactly. So the team systematically took 55 of those candidates and tagged them with a fluorescent marker called neon green.
Right, to physically look at where these proteins live inside living, adhered parasites.
And the comparative analysis here is where the data really crystallizes. They compared free-swimming cells with long flagella to the adhered cells with the stumpy flagella.
And out of those 55 candidates, 32 cleanly and specifically localized directly to the adhered flagellum.
Proving that they actively migrate to the contact zone when the parasite builds its anchor.
Wow. And examining the genetic identities of those 32 proteins revealed a really profound evolutionary pattern.
Yeah, 7 of them formed a highly specific cluster, and nearly all were encoded sequentially on chromosome 32.
Syntony like that, you know, genes clustered together on the same chromosome, is a massive red flag in genomics.
A huge red flag. It almost always points to a family of related proteins that arose through gene duplication.
They evolve in tandem to perform a unified, specialized function. And the researchers named this newly discovered group the adhesion-related NTPase-like domain family, or the ARND family.
And the top hit from their entire mass spec screen was the canonical member of this family, which they designated KIP4.
Okay, here's where it gets really interesting. Identifying the ARND family was a huge structural breakthrough, but it introduced a massive biological paradox.
Right, based on its sequence homology.
Because the name itself, NTPase-like domain, implies a biological motor. An NTPase domain usually burns energy, like ATP or GTP, to generate mechanical work.
But when you look at the sequence data for these ARND proteins, they're missing a critical piece of architecture.
They completely lack the Walker A motif. And that's the highly conserved loop that actually cradles the phosphate of the ATP molecule.
Exactly. Without it, the nucleotide cannot bind. These domains are catalytically dead.
So the big question is, why would a parasite construct its most vital structural anchor out of inactive broken engines?
It seems totally counterintuitive until you analyze how evolution repurposes existing protein folds. They aren't broken engines, they are repurposed structural scaffolds.
Ah, so it doesn't require them to generate kinetic energy anymore. It's just exploiting their physical three-dimensional shape.
Right. It's taking an old, heavy engine block and utilizing it strictly for its bulk, like a boat anchor.
The mechanical rotation doesn't matter, just the physical mass and rigidity.
Precisely. A perfect biological parallel is the septin family of proteins, which are found everywhere across eukaryotes.
Right. Septins also have nucleotide binding domains, but their job is entirely structural.
Exactly. They polymerize into highly rigid, tough filaments that interface directly with the cell membrane, physically bending and sculpting it.
And KEAP4 and the alin proteins operate on a similar thermodynamic principle. They serve as the structural rebar,
forming a rigid lattice that forces the flagellar membrane to flatten out, conform to the irregularities of the insect's chitin, and create that unbreakable fluid seal.
Okay, but to prove that KEAP4 actually functions as the load-bearing rebar of that seal, you have to break the system.
Which they did. The team generated a genetic knockout, deploying CRISPR to delete the KEAP4 gene entirely and then analyze the fallout.
Right. In vitro, meaning, just adhered to a glass substrate in a dish, these mutants exhibited a severe reduction in attachment capacity.
But adhering to uniform glass lacks the chaotic fluid dynamics of a living vector. The definitive test was in vivo infecting actual sandflies.
And the in vivo data is just fascinating. The mutant parasites weren't actually compromised in their general viability.
No, they survived the hostile environment of the fly's gut perfectly fine. They proliferated normally and migrated all the way to the cardia,
which is the anatomical region situated immediately posterior to the stomodial valve, right?
Yes. They successfully navigated the entire developmental gauntlet right up to the final millimeter.
But they catastrophically failed to cross that final threshold and actually colonize the valve itself.
So they physically reached the front door, but entirely lacked the molecular scaffolding to wedge themselves into the frame against the current.
And verifying that failure required visualizing the fly's gut architecture directly, which they did using calcofluor.
Right. Yeah, calcofluor is a fluorescent dye that selectively binds to chitin.
And chitin forms the tough cuticular exoskeleton and lines the foregut of the fly.
Right, so in an uninfected sandfly, a calcofluor stain illuminates the stomodial valve with this brilliant, continuous blue fluorescent signal showing the chitin is perfectly intact.
But when you infect a fly with normal wild-type leishmania,
the parasites adhere and aggressively degrade that chitin layer, likely through mechanical pressure and secreted chitinases.
Staining those infected valves reveals a massive depletion of the blue signal. The structural integrity is just fundamentally ruined.
But here's the kicker. When they applied the calcofluor stain to the flies infected with the KRP4 knockout mutants,
the stomodial valve remained pristine. It glowed bright blue, completely undamaged.
Exactly. Because the mutant parasites lacked the AR&D scaffolding, they couldn't assemble the adhesion plaque.
And without the plaque, they couldn't maintain the localized attachment required to actually exert force and deliver those enzymes that degrade the chitin.
What's fascinating here is how that preservation of the chitin lining radically alters the macroscopic trajectory of the disease.
Right, because if the valve remains structurally intact, the fly's digestive tract isn't obstructed.
It can feed to satiation. It doesn't enter that frantic, repetitive biting cycle driven by starvation.
And crucially, it isn't forced to regurgitate parasites into subsequent mammalian hosts.
By isolating KRP4, the researchers haven't just characterized a cellular anchor. They have identified a fundamental off switch for the entire transmission cycle.
Which immediately raises a much broader evolutionary question. If leishmania relies on this specific AR&D scaffolding to hijack the sandfly, is this a one-off trick?
Right, like, is this a highly localized, species-specific adaptation, or did other kinetoplastid parasites independently arrive at the exact same mechanical solution?
And the bioinformatics data provides a definitive answer.
It does. By mapping the genomes across the kinetoplastid family tree, they discovered that the AR&D gene family is ancient
and highly conserved across parasites that require permanent adhesion to their respective insect vectors.
Meaning the genetic blueprint for this glue is conserved, even among parasites facing entirely different fluid dynamic challenges.
Right, take Trypanosoma congolens and Trypanosoma brucei. the parasites responsible for African sleeping sickness.
They reside in the tsetse fly, a completely different vector, and they don't attach by the tip of their flagellum like Leishmania does.
They utilize lateral adhesion, laying the entire length of the flagellum flat against the host tissue.
Yet, they deploy the exact same molecular toolkit to achieve it.
The proof is so cool. The researchers endogenously tagged the ARND proteins in Trypanosoma congolens, and the fluorescence lit up perfectly along that lateral attachment zone.
It is the exact same family of scaffolding proteins, utilized in a completely different architectural configuration to achieve the same mechanical dominance over the vector.
And the ultimate validation of that, the exception that proves the rule, is examining the kinetoplastids that don't form permanent attachments.
Organisms like Bodo saltans, which is free living, and Trypanosoma rangeli.
Right. Both of these species exhibit only transient adhesion. They briefly touch down on a substrate, but they don't construct these massive permanent adhesion plaques.
In imperfect alignment with the biomechanical requirements, genomic analysis confirms that both of those species completely lack the ARND gene family.
Wow. It is a precise evolutionary absolute. The presence of this repurposed, catalytically dead engine scaffold is strictly tied to the requirement for permanent adhesion.
Looking at the sheer scale of what this paper uncovers is incredible. We've traced a massive global health bottleneck down to a 10 nanometer blast radius around a single protein.
Yeah, we saw how Turboid bypassed the limitations of traditional affinity purification to map that adhesion plaque. It revealed this ancient family of inactive NTPase domains operating as structural rebar.
And most importantly, knocking out that single scaffold prevents the destruction of the sandfly's throat, effectively neutralizing the regurgitation reflex that drives global transmission.
It's a profound synthesis of molecular biochemistry and vector epidemiology.
But the widespread conservation of this ARND family leaves you with a really compelling question. We've seen how ancient gene duplications allowed divergent parasites to independently adapt this exact same molecular toolkit to conquer completely different insect vectors.
Right, millions of years apart.
Exactly. So what does this mean for the future? If this scaffolding family was hiding in plain sight this whole time, what other shared ancient molecular toolkits are hiding in their genomes, waiting to be exploited as universal transmission blockers?
Definitely something to mull over next time you swat away a fly. This episode was based on an open access article under the CC BY 4.0 license. You can find a direct link to the paper and the license in our episode description. If you enjoyed this, follow or subscribe in your podcast app and leave a 5-star rating. If you'd like to support our work, use the donation link in the description. Now, stay with us for an original track created especially for this episode and inspired by the article you just heard about. Thanks for listening, and join us next time as we explore more science base by base. Under cold blue screens, the night stays wide awake. A tiny travel learns the hold it has to take. On a narrow threshold where the currents twist and roll, it builds a quiet landing gear for its whole soul.
Start. No walker to walk, no spark. cycle. Yeah.